The Athletic.
Hello, welcome to this week's Athletic Football Tactics podcast. We're delighted that you've chosen to listen to us today, us being Michael Cox and Mark Carey from The Athletic, and myself, Ali Maxwell. Those two are writers and experts on the topics of football tactics and analytics, which also happen to be the things I'm most interested in talking about. So that's what we do each and every week on this show. Mark Carey joins us as always. How are you doing, Mark?
Good, thank you, Ali. Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts that I want to air for this week's episode. I think this is going to be a good one, and I've got some opinions to share.
Wow. Insight, analysis, sure. Opinions.
I know.
Looking forward to it. Plenty of interesting data work on the Athletic site recently. I'm seeing pieces on Arsenal's slick passing, on Brentford's interest in Christian Eriksen, on the beauty of Liverpool's midfielder Fabinho, all with your name on the byline, alongside some colleagues, of course.
Yeah, that's right. I think the Arsenal one, something we spoke about on the pod a few weeks ago, I think, just in terms of how productive they've actually been going forward. It was something that at the time I was speaking to Art, our Arsenal writer, on. And managed to get some data on it and you know, work with him on that, which was quite an interesting one. But yeah, always working with all the writers at The Athletic.
And Michael's been doing some writing of his own. Michael, Manchester City against Chelsea over the weekend, and you were writing about this one tactically. We saw three significant Chelsea wins against City last season, but this time out, any feeling that Tuchel has the antidote to Pep's tactics has been somewhat dispelled, I'd say, by the two fixtures this season. Both of them won 1-0 by Manchester City. What was the tactical story of this game?
I was quite disappointed by this game, to be honest. I ended up writing about the roles of the front three. I think City's all did different things. Grealish running in behind, Foden pressing very well, Sterling staying wide and stretching the play against Alonso. So I thought those three did well individually, but to be honest, I thought it was a kind of a 0-0 game. I mean, the goal was a moment of magic, I suppose, out of nothing. The big games this season involving Liverpool have been great, but the two between Manchester City and Chelsea, I think, have been a little bit flat and uneventful, albeit Manchester City definitely the better side in both games.
And on that topic, I just wanted to scratch an itch that I've had over the last few weeks, because I can't get the formation 4-6-0 out of my head. And I suspect when I ask you if Manchester City's current strikerless approach could be called 4-6-0, you might let me down. If that is the case, is that a possible football formation, or have I just come up with that and it doesn't really exist?
No, I mean, I remember a lot of people talking about it kind of theoretically, like in 2008 when Spalletti first used Totti as his main striker. The six kind of implies they're all roughly on the same kind of level, doesn't it? Whereas I think these days, if we're talking about 4-2-3-1 and there's four bands in the system, I mean, I don't mind 4-3-3-0. Can we kind of come to a compromise on that?
Yeah, I'm delighted with that. I'll certainly take that, the 4-3-3-0. Thank you. I had to get that question out of the way. Today's topic, though, is not, for once, about Manchester City's strikerless formation. It concerns the FIFPro Men and Women's World 11s for 2021, which were announced on Monday. And obviously, the very nature of these sorts of recognition vessels leads to plenty of raised eyebrows, plenty of consternation, some of it just for the sake of it, and some of it probably merited as well. It's, of course, what keeps the football media world turning, the content wheel churning it out. The FIFPro World 11s haven't disappointed on that front, although for very different reasons. And we thought it would be worth taking a look at them. We're going to discuss both men and women's teams on this podcast. First, with Michael and Mark, we'll take a look at the FIFPro Men's World 11 and any agreements or issues they have with it and their own selections. And then Mark will sub out for Alex Ibaseta, who will join us in the second half of the pod to discuss the various issues or the good parts of the Women's World 11. It always seems a good idea to actually understand how the process works rather than just seeing the graphic of the team and taking issue but barking up the wrong tree. So although we might not say it out loud generally, this stuff does interest almost every football fan. And for some reason, questions of teams of the season, teams of the year, you can't avoid ending up with an opinion of sorts. What was your response to the release of the FIFPro teams on Monday?
I find the formation quite funny. I mean, 3-3-4, they are real four outright attackers, aren't they? It's always just a slightly weird mix of things. I'm never quite sure what people are voting for, what the criteria is. I'm not sure whether it's kind of the best of the year or whether it's kind of the best in terms of reputation. It's always just a slightly odd mix. The men's one was weird. The women's one was just, I mean, I don't like to use the word disgraceful because, you know, it's only voting for a select 11, but I mean, there's some bizarre choices on that one. That is quite shocking, I think.
And Mark, I certainly perceive that one of the things I've learned most from reading the writing about data analysis in football is understanding a little better the various cognitive biases that human beings have, and no less so than in football, and perhaps more than ever in voting for these sorts of things, in having opinions on these sorts of things. There's always a lot of bias at play, isn't there? And I guess for someone like you, you must sort of note that and have to park that at the door every time you decide to get upset or not about these teams.
Yeah, it's easy to lean on the numbers, I think, when you're sort of comparing and contrasting, especially in kind of forward areas as well. Because, I mean, aside from that, it is just one opinion against the other. I suppose this whole voting is just, you know, a load of people's opinions, which is what's great. But yeah, maybe another time we could have a statistical team of the year, which I can come into my own on. But yeah, no, I just to echo everything Michael said from the men's and the women's team, the 3-3-4 is... But this is my first opinion. I think that's a nonsense. I think if there was a 3-3-4 in, you know, real life football, I think more people would actually do it if it were effective. I don't know any team. It'd be interesting to know whether there's any team that's actually set up like that kind of from the starting lineup and not just, you know, evolved into that on the pitch. But yeah, that's my first grievance.
I'm pretty sure, Michael, that some of Bielsa's formations in this Leeds job, although maybe not right now, and in previous jobs particularly, we might have approached or achieved a 3-3-3-1 or a 3-3-1-3, but I've certainly never heard of a 3-3-4.
Yeah, you really need number 10, don't you, to do that? I mean, are we having Lewandowski behind the other three? Is Messi the 10 with one of Lewandowski and Haaland out wide? I don't know. I'm slightly struggling to come to terms with the formation. I mean, usually they've been all right on that. I think every other year it's been a pretty standard 4-3-3 or something similar with two fullbacks. So I don't quite know what has gone wrong on the voting for this one. It might just be one of those things that when they added up the votes, there wasn't a fourth defender that had that many votes, whereas there were four attackers. So they just bunged them in the team, which I do sympathise with.
Yeah, so I think at this point it's worth me boringly sort of clarifying how the process works and what these awards are, essentially. Despite the name FIFA Pro World Team 11 for 2021, this asks professional footballers to vote on those who have been the best in their position during the 2021 season. So it's only for the completed last season, is not the calendar year of 2021, that the process itself, collecting the votes, asking the 25,000 participating professional footballers for their votes, that started in August, just after the Tokyo Summer Olympics finished. So you can see that nothing from this season contributes to the vote, and that might be something that was missed in the discourse around its initial release. So, for example, none of Mo Salah, who is conspicuous by his absence, none of his 22 goals this season between August and New Year's Day contribute or counted to this vote. The players were able to select any player in the world, by the way, but the voting tool does contain a guidance list with approximately 250 player names. The players who vote select three footballers who they think have been the best in their position during the 2021 season, and the four positions to choose from are goalkeepers, defenders, midfielders, and forwards. So the three footballers they think have been best in their position in those four categories. And then, of course, it churns out the goalkeeper, as well as three defenders, three midfielders, and three forwards who receive the most votes. They automatically go into the World 11. The remaining spot goes to the outfield player with the next highest number of votes. So, boringly, that explains the 3-3-4, doesn't it, really? We were automatically going to have three defenders, three midfielders, and three forwards. Just so happens, unsurprisingly, that the remaining spot in the World 11 was assigned to the outfield player with the next highest number of votes, who was one of Lewandowski, Messi, Ronaldo, and Haaland. So there you go. We've cleared that up a little bit. The team itself is Donnarumma in goal, Ruben Dias, David Alaba and Leonardo Bonucci in the back three, Jorginho, Kante and De Bruyne in the midfield three, and of course that famous front four of Ronaldo, Messi, Haaland and Lewandowski. What are your general thoughts about this team, Michael?
I mean, it's not shocking. I mean, Messi and Ronaldo's presence, they've been in it every year going back to 2008. I mean, every single year, even when there's been years where maybe there's a chance someone else can come in. So it seems to be with these teams, there is a bit of a kind of lag effect. They stay in it for pretty longer than they deserve. I mean, Iniesta was in it in 2017, which I think was a similar case.
It's almost like a sort of deference, isn't it?
Yeah, I think when you get players voting for other players, they've really gone talent and reputation. I think, you know, a lot of players are not watching football week in, week out, but will have played against a certain player 2 years ago and still think, oh, they're the, you know, they're still a brilliant talent or whatever. And yeah, it does seem there's a bit of a lag. But I mean, the team is, to a certain extent, reflects what happened this year. I mean, Jorginho, Bonucci, Donnarumma obviously won the Euros. Dias, I don't think, would have been in the top 20 or 30 the previous year before he joined Man City. So it, to a certain extent, it's reflective form as well.
And because of the format, which we've just explained, Mark, we get this situation where a back three of Dias outside right centre-back, Bonucci at the heart of it, Alaba left centre-back, that, you know, in terms of taking to the pitch, hypothetically, could be very nice indeed. And in midfield, again, just in terms of the types of players, you've got quite a nice balance of Jorginho, the sort of sitting passer, the organiser. You've got a ball-winning midfield extraordinaire in Kante and a sensational creative and goal-scoring midfielder as well in KDB. So it's a nice balance they've got there. But it means zero fullbacks or wingbacks at all. A position maybe more than any that we've spoken about as having developed a greater tactical importance in this year in particular. That is, conspicuous by its absence.
Yeah, that was going to be my second grievance of the lack of fullbacks, which, again, as you say, it's something we've spoken about a lot on the podcast. I think, yeah, it's something I think I've spoken about before in terms of sort of the best 11 or the 11 best. And I suppose this is more of a kind of a best 11 on, you know, individuals, because that's, I guess, how the voting works. But the dynamic of the team is something that's interesting as well. And as you say, that midfield three would work. And obviously, Jorginho and Kante play in the same team. You know, at club level, it would feasibly work. But I just find it interesting to look at how the team on offer would actually shape up if they were to play against, I don't even know who, but you know, if they were actually play as a 11. So you know, it's got a good enough balance, but I think the width is my second grievance.
Michael, you mentioned that, you know, we shouldn't expect that professional footballers are watching professional football all of the time, and yet there's enough of this group of 25,000 professional footballers watching Sao Paulo in Brazil to know that Dani Alves had an incredible 2021 season. He made the list of the 23 most votes, albeit not into the final team, which goes to show that maybe there's a bit of a blind spot in terms of judging fullbacks from the players themselves.
Yeah, that's another example of the lag effect. I mean, I know he's back at Barcelona now, but you do think that's probably based around kind of form from 2 or 3 years ago. And I think you can say the same for the women's vote as well. So, yeah, I must say, that completely passed me by that Alves had got quite a few votes. But the fullback remains the kind of unfashionable position as far as players are concerned. That's maybe what we can conclude.
Wow, this is the Athletic Football Tactics podcast, where fullbacks have been incredibly fashionable this season. And it's where Michael and Cox and Mark Kerry have softly judged the FIFPro Men's World 11 for 2021 so far. And now it's their turn to put their necks on the line and pick a team themselves. Okay, guys, before picking your teams, there are a few key questions that we have to get out the way. First and foremost, again, confusingly, this is called the World 11 for 2021, but are you staying true to the actual voting process, staying true to this being just from the 2021 season, or did you decide to go rogue and go full calendar year here?
I mean, yeah, I'm not one to go against the rules, never have been. So I'm sticking to the 2020-21 season. I've included the Euros as well, because I think, as you say, it wrapped up in August. So including sort of the Euros in my picks. But yeah, I'm staying true to the way it was done.
What about our renegade colleague, Michael?
I've given a bit of consideration to the second half of last year. I think more emphasis on the first year, in part because that's when the big games are, that's when the finals are, that's where the run-in is. You know, it does make sense to put more emphasis on that. Mm. But there's certain things I don't think you can completely disregard the second half of the year. I think the goalkeeper position is probably quite a good example of that.
Any 3-3-4s?
None from me. You know my opinion on it. None from me. No, I'll give my formation away now. I'm going to stick with the 4-3-3. But no, I'm trying to, again, it comes back to me. I'm trying to, a bit more of a purist. I want it to be a sort of a best 11 as much as an 11 best. So I'm trying to keep balance in my side.
Michael, is 4-3-3, you know, in general team of the year terms, is that the fairest formation in terms of balancing out the sort of number of players from each position on the football pitch? Or do you prefer some people like to go for a 4-4-2 or a 4-2-4 type so that you can get an extra shiny goal scorer in there, even if it sometimes means your shiny wide forwards get put at right and left mid in a 4-4-2 on paper?
Yeah, it's always tempting to go for the extra attacker, and that is what I've done for the women's team. But for the men's team, I've got 4 defenders, 3 midfielders and 3 attackers, but I think probably a diamond formation would be best suited to this collection of players.
Well, I hope you haven't joined the fullback boycott that the professional players ran in this on this front, because you're going to need fullbacks in a 4-diamond 2, that's for sure. Let's not start with the goalkeeper. I've got one more important question which will kick off you running us through the players that you've selected here. A very, very important question. Do Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi deserve to make this team? If we had our memories wiped and any previous footballing knowledge or recognition or context wiped from any time before the 1st of, or probably the 1st of August, I suppose, 2020, and we had no idea who players were, no memories, we only measure it on footballing performance. Michael, do they both make it in?
I think they'd both be strong contenders. I think Messi makes it in because he was the best player by far in the Copa America. Ronaldo's, I mean, his goal scoring numbers are still exceptional, but I think he'd miss out just because there are 3 or 4 other players in the mix in terms of getting those incredible goal scoring numbers. So he wouldn't be in my 2 centre forwards I've got.
It was an interesting one for them on this front, because in terms of team titles, they've won so many that generally, if that's something that you prioritise for these awards, it's pretty easy to put them in, even aside from what they were doing personally, which was also the best we'd ever seen, right? Last season, neither of them had a particularly strong year at club level, right? I mean, Ronaldo's Juventus side, favourites for the title, didn't win it. Messi's Barcelona side, among the favourites for the title, didn't win it. So that adds an interesting wrinkle here. Mark, what was your decision?
Yeah, mine's, I almost want to use it like countdown and show my workings a little bit, but it was very, very similar to Michael's in terms of, yeah, what Messi did at international level. And also his kind of all-round game, which we know to be kind of, you know, he's a goal scorer, but he's far more of a creator than Ronaldo. And Ronaldo got 29 goals last season, which was the third highest of the top 5 European leagues. Messi on 30, just above him. But Messi got 9 assists as well, and Ronaldo only got 2. So in terms of the all-round contribution, if, you know, thinking of the balance of my team, I think that, as we know, Messi's got that kind of dual threat, which Ronaldo doesn't quite have. And is, as we found out this season, quieter when he's not necessarily scoring goals.
Right, Messi's in both, Ronaldo is in neither, and I'm just off to mute my Twitter notifications after the publishing of this podcast. Let's go a little more traditionally now. Michael, the FIFA Pro Men's World 11 goalkeeper was Donnarumma, with Diaz, Alaba and Bonucci, it's 3 defenders. How have you approached your back 5?
I do get the Donnarumma thing. I mean, he won the Euros Player of the Year. He essentially was the guy who won the final for Italy and the semi-final as well. I went for Jan Oblak. He was La Liga Player of the Year. He's just a brilliant shot stopper. It's very rare that a goalkeeper wins an individual award. And I think to do that, obviously, as title winners for a bit of an outsider, meant that he was, I think, the better option than Donnarumma. And to kind of repeat what I said before, Donnarumma's barely played since the summer. So I think that, you know, you have to factor in a little bit of what happened since then. My back 4, I had 2 players who were in the official team. They were Bonucci and Diaz. I think Bonucci in particular, for his performance at the Euros, scored an equaliser in the final. Okay, it was a tap-in. His diagonal balls, I think, was so crucial to the way Italy played. I think really Bonucci is probably a bit underrated in terms of his, you know, overall impact over the last decade or so. He's been, aside from that dodgy season at Milan, which was very weird, he's been very consistent and a really, really top defender, certainly one of the best defenders I've seen. And the fullbacks, I haven't ignored fullbacks, of course. On the left, I went for João Cancelo, who's just interpreted the role in a completely different way to what I've seen before. His outside of the book passes, his kind of real playmaking ability. Weird thing about Cancelo is he's left out of the team for the Champions League final, which probably gets forgotten a bit, but slightly odd that he'd miss out of the Champions League final, but definitely get the vote for my World 11, but there you go. And on the other side, I've gone for Hakimi, who was a wing-back rather than a full-back for Inter, but he was just brilliant. And I think he might prove PSG's best signing of last summer, and that's a summer where they got Donnarumma, Ramos and Messi in, but I think he's fantastic. He can just dominate a flank on his own, which is very helpful for my diamond formation.
It always feels quite reductive when people just shout names of people that aren't in your team at you as a form of criticism. But that is also partially my job. Talk me through Hakimi over Trent Alexander-Arnold, for example.
Well, I don't think... I mean, I think Alexander-Arnold is brilliant, but I don't think he had a great year, did he? I mean, his form with Liverpool last season wasn't great. There was the, you know, bit of controversy when he was left out of the England squad initially. He then would have got into the England squad, but missed out on the Euros through injury. So I just don't think you can include him for this year over Hakimi.
Mark, your debut on this podcast last year was talking us through measuring goalkeeper, more specifically shot-stopping performance, and talking through how you can measure other parts of the goalkeeping game as well. So I trust that your goalkeeper pick will be definitive. I'll certainly trust you over Coxie on this front. Who have you got in nets and in your back four?
Yeah, you know me very well, because I've gone straight for the numbers. I mean, I wouldn't be doing my job properly on the podcast if I wasn't using the numbers for this. But yeah, I looked at goals prevented from last season across the top five European leagues. So goals prevented being that metric that looks at the difference between the number of goals that a goalkeeper should have conceded based on the quality of the shot and the actual number of goals that they did concede. And Jan Oblak was the top. He was my pick as well. So he prevented just shy of 10 goals more than he should have last season based on the quality of shots that he faced. So huge shot-stopping performance from him across the year or the season. And obviously Atletico Madrid being the title winners, obviously after 7 years.
Good one for me just to jump in here to flag up that per Opta Analyst and their sort of live season data that they have on their site, dataviz.theanalyst.com, Jan Oblak currently bottom in La Liga in terms of goals prevented and pretty much bottom, yeah, in terms of starting goalkeepers for goals prevented rate. So it just goes to show, doesn't it, Mark, what I'm sure you told us at that time, that a little bit like XG over or under performance, goalkeeper shot-stopping performance doesn't tend to be hugely consistent season to season, which is, well, it's a bit of a shame because it makes our life a bit harder.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly as you say, it can be quite patchy, you know, quite form-based, a whole host of different factors at both ends, as you say, from a goalkeeper perspective, also from an attacker's perspective as well. And it's something that I did a piece on with Dermot Corrigan, our writer for La Liga, on fairly recently about that sort of change and maybe what's going wrong in Atleti's defence as well. But yeah, he's keeping it strictly to that season. He did come out as top. And it seems like before you guys were kind of essentially reading out the notes that I've made, because I genuinely didn't know what you've chosen, Michael, in terms of your defensive line. But mine is kind of very similar. I've gone for Ruben Diaz at the back for the same reasons. Man City's defence was so, so strong in the sort of their title win last season that you'd obviously look more towards the attack for Man City, but their defence was so, so strong and he was key to that. I've gone for Thiago Silva as well at the back. Obviously, he normally plays within a back three, but he can sort of cope in a back two alongside Diaz here. Really solid, obviously, at the back. And, is, you know, he transformed Chelsea's defence from when he came in, and obviously them getting
big
the
intangibles
League.
As well. And you love an intangible.
Exactly. The intangibles, I was going to say.
Those things that you can't measure, Mark. That's what keeps you up
I know,
at night.
Yeah, yeah, it gives me nightmares. But I think he's a real example of that. So I think that's key as well. It's something we could maybe speak about in the future about kind of how to sort of quantify defensive quality. Really difficult in defenders because, you know, sometimes just because a defender has more actions defensively doesn't mean that they're necessarily a better defender for reasons that we can come on to another time. But Thiago Silva and Ruben Diaz are my centre-backs. I wrote down here that I did debate Trent Alexander-Arnold. He still got 7 assists last season from an expected assists rate of 8.1, which was interesting. But I also wrote Hakimi for me. 7 goals and 8 assists for Inter Milan, but that's sort of based on outcome. But as you say, Michael, he was just so, so key to Inter Milan's title win last season. He's an absolute speedster as well. I think that James Horncastle did a piece going back last year of just showing just how lightning quick he is, and using data from Skill Corner, who can sort of provide physical data. I think he was one of the fastest players in the whole of Serie A last season before obviously going to PSG since. So Achraf Hakimi for me at right back. And this actually isn't based on data here. This is just more on vibes, based on the Euros. Was Leonardo Spinazzola for me. I think he was absolutely key to the way that Italy played, especially getting to the latter stages. I know that he was obviously then struck down by injury, but I think the way that he worked together with Lorenzo Insigne on the left-hand side was just brilliant. And again, I think there was a piece that you wrote, Michael, which just showed and highlighted just how well he was doing during the Euros. So Spinazzola on the left for me, brilliant attacking left back.
When even our data analysis expert is using vibes as the main reason for a pick in this team, you realise why. It's just, well, it's such a ridiculous thing to be doing, and how you could never, never, never agree on it. Although you do have Oblak, Diaz, Hakimi. Both of you have picked those three in your back five. Let's start, Mark, with your midfield. Think it's a midfield three for you?
Midfield three for me. I could have gone for Jorginho. And I think if you think about all the things that he'd won, and I guess that's why his name was sort of spoken so much within the Ballon d'Or as well. But he has had a great individual season. But I've gone for N'Golo Kante. In my defensive midfield role, I know that he's kind of more of a shuttler up and down more recently, but I'm going to put him in my defensive midfield because he can play it. He was the man of the match on the day in the Champions League final as well. And obviously, don't need to speak too much about the qualities that he has. So he's going in my defensive midfield. Toni Kroos is going to go on my left of the three. Just again, thinking of my balance of my midfield, he can sort of rotate as well if Kante were to move forward a little bit.
Does this mean in your eyes last season he's still, as he has been at times over his career, the sort of premier playmaker from deep areas, the premier passer in world football, I guess?
Yeah, everyone knows how good his passing is. But again, looking into the numbers, he actually had a fantastic season sort of by the numbers. He had 10 assists in La Liga, and he actually had the highest expected assists per 90 of players other than Lionel Messi. So the second highest, I suppose you could say. But he had 0.28 expected assists per 90. So he's essentially creating chances worthy of an assist roughly one every three games. So you know how good his qualities are, but he had a good season by the statistics. So Toni Kroos is there, and I am going to agree with Kevin De Bruyne in the middle as well. Interestingly, he only played 58% of Man City's total league minutes last season. So not, he wasn't playing a great deal. I know that injuries come into that as well, but he still managed 11 assists in that time, which was, the highest in the league. 0.5 assists per 90, and that was completely in line with his expected assist as well. So creating chances and getting an assist every other game, which was just so strong. So I was debating Joshua Kimmich as well, but my three is N'Golo Kante, Toni Kroos and Kevin De Bruyne.
Interesting, just as an aside, when you do make these teams, you should probably always have a kind of minutes played threshold, right? I feel like KDB is kind of on the border there. 58% of total minutes, but what he did on the pitch, certainly can't argue with. Michael, talk us through your diamond.
Yeah, completely different players to Mark, so hey. I'm pleased to say, for some variety. I went for Jorginho over Kante as a Chelsea player because of the Euros. I think he was very good in the European Championship and pretty good, although not quite as good as Kante during the Champions League run. But I think the double success doesn't earn you the Ballon d'Or, but I think it does earn you a place in this team. Mark had Toni Kroos. I went for Ilkay Gundogan. I mean, he was a top scorer for the team that won the Premier League title from midfield, and didn't really seem to get much of a look in these kind of awards. It's also worth pointing out he's so good in a deep role that Guardiola was content to leave out Rodri and Fernandinho and play him in the Champions League final. You can argue whether that worked or not. I don't think that was the reason why they lost, but he's just such a good all-round midfielder, can play any role really in midfield. And De Bruyne, I love De Bruyne, but A little bit like with Alexander-Arnold, I didn't think this was his best year. And like you say, Mark, he wasn't playing that much. And so in a kind of similar role, I went for Nicola Barella, who I think is one of very few players who had a great 2021 season and also a great Euros. Obviously won the league for Inter and won the European Championship for Italy. So yeah, he's my third one. The top of my diamond is very much an attacking player. So I'll include him in the front three if that's fine, Ali.
Okay, but we know who it is, don't we?
You can guess, yes.
The false nine, Lionel Messi.
Yes, Messi, whether he's coming inside for the right or number 10 position. Yep, he's there. I think particularly because of the Copa America victory. I mean, he was the best player in that tournament by a country mile. Even if you'd never seen him play before, you would have been assured that he was pretty much the best player in South America and quite close to the best player in the world. There's quite a lot of options up front. I think Lukaku actually deserves a shout, despite the fact he's been struggling recently. I mean, he was brilliant for Inter and also very good at the European Championships. Erling Haaland's goal-scoring record gets him very close. But I've gone for, I guess, two veterans now. Robert Lewandowski, whose goal record speaks for itself. And Karim Benzema, who's just improved so much since, I think particularly since Ronaldo left Real Madrid, and is an assister really as much as he is a number nine. I think both of those players could easily play as a number 10. So yeah, Messi, Benzema, Lewandowski for my front three.
Any differences in opinion in your front three, Mark?
The only one I've stuck with is Erling Haaland. I think you're completely right, Michael, about Karim Benzema. I think this season, especially, Benzema's numbers are fantastic. Him and Vinicius Jr. for Real Madrid are just, you know, together they are just pulling Madrid through. So I'm trying to think, yeah, he did do well last season. I haven't got the numbers completely to hand, but I think maybe there's something there in Benzema's start to, or, you know, halfway through this season as well. Which might be a little bit of recency effect, but he has done so, so brilliantly. Haaland's, 27 goals in 28 games last season, which is just frightening. Added six assists to that as well. And looking at the sort of the goal contribution or the direct goal contribution of either a goal or assist, he's got Haaland's 1.2 goals or assists per 90. So he's contributing, directly to a goal at least every other game, which is quite frightening. Lewandowski's 41 goals and 7 assists in that season is just unbelievable. 1.8 goals and assists per 90. So that's nearly 2 direct goal contributions per game, which is just unbelievable. So, he's in there for me. And just echoing everything we've said already about Lionel Messi, double threat. He obviously had the Copa America. His goal contribution, he scored 30 goals and people were saying he's maybe on a bit of a downward trend, but that's I think it was the third highest of anyone in the top five European leagues. So for me, Messi, Haaland and Lewandowski.
Interestingly, in the long list of 23 players that were voted on by the 25,000 votees or voters, we did have Neymar and Mbappe on the long list in terms of the forward players, alongside all of the guys you've mentioned, Benz, Ronaldo, Haaland, Lewandowski and Messi and Lukaku. But of course, Mbappe and Neymar not making it into the official team, nor either of your teams. It does mean that we have a five-a-side team, basically, that you agree on. And that has Oblak in its goal. It has Ruben Dias. It has Ashraf Hakimi, and then Messi and Lewandowski, which pleasingly seems like an incredible balanced five-a-side team in terms of someone that you couldn't score past, an absolute speedster, a rock at the back who can play, and Lewandowski and Messi, who you could imagine Lewandowski with his back to goal, you're not going to get much off him, and as finishing goes, not many better, and Messi is the greatest player that's ever lived. So there you go. The full teams were for Mark: Oblak, Hakimi, Dias, Thiago Silva and Spinazzola, Kante, KDB and Kroos in midfield, with Haaland, Messi and Lewandowski up front, and Michael, Oblak in goal, Hakimi of course, Dias, Bonucci and Cancelo, a midfield of Jorginho, Gundogan and Barella. Very different to, or at least 2 out of 3, very different to those who found their way into the official team, with Messi, Lewandowski and Benzema as well. Of the 11 that made it into the official team, spare your thoughts for Donnarumma, who was its goalkeeper, not mentioned, or rather not selected by either of you. Alaba as well in defence. That was an interesting inclusion, I thought, in the official team. So I'm sort of not that surprised to see him absent from your selections. And Ronaldo, as discussed as well, not making it into your teams. A very interesting exercise. And it's quite funny that, and I'm certainly not having a go at either of you, but I consider you guys in different ways to be absolutely the sort of people to put together some almost definitive 11s on this front. But A, half of your teams are different from each other's, and B, whether it was Spinazzola's vibes or, you know, Michael waiting Jorginho's sort of team honours, that sort of thing, you do see, and his inclusion of Barella particularly, which came somewhat out the blue, you see that everyone's opinions are different, and that's what makes it so much fun to talk about. Next up, we've got the FIFA Pro Women's World 11 of 2021 in the crosshairs. This is the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. We say goodbye to Mark Carey and we'll say welcome to Alex Ibaceta. Yeah, we're really lucky to be able to welcome Alex Ibaceta to the podcast. Alex, a debutant on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast, but host of Box to Box WSL, which is a football podcast that focuses on tactical analysis of women's football. So it's a short-term loan deal that makes a lot of sense. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Yeah, no worries. I'm quite impressed with the pronunciation of my last name, if I'm being honest. Got that spot on.
He's always worried about that, so he'll be pleased.
It's exactly the sort of boost that I needed today. Thank you. I'm someone that responds very well to praise. So thank you. Michael's normally going the other way and, you know, it does affect my performance at times. The reason we got Alex on is to help us to understand, if that's the right word, the FIFA Pro Women's World 11 that came out on Monday, like we have done with the men's team. This is the Women's World 11 for 2021, although as you're going to tell us afterwards, it might as well be the team for, what, 2019? Who's in it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of very familiar names. I think that's the key thing. Goalkeeper was Christiane Endler of PSG. The back four was Lucy Bronze, Millie Bright, Magda Eriksson, and Wendy Renard. Midfield three was Carly Lloyd, Estefania Bonini, Barbara Bonasea, and up front was Marta Vivian Miedemar and Alex Morgan, which, yeah, as you imply, could have been picked a couple of years ago and doesn't seem to be based that much upon what happened in 2021, even, you know, withstanding the things you said at the top about how it was kind of voted for in August or September, even once you include that, it's still quite odd.
Quite a lot to unpack here. But Alex, as we are a tactics podcast, first and foremost, and we've just discussed the men's team being a 3-3-4 formation, which simply doesn't exist. Are there any frivolous tactical or positional issues here?
Not entirely, to be fair. I think mostly, with the exception of Magda Eriksson, who's obviously mainly a centre back, playing as a left back, you could probably get away with it. but not, I mean, there's plenty of left backs, as we'll probably get into it later. I actually struggled for this position. It was the only one that I struggled with. But yeah, that's everyone else is fairly decent, I would say. But yeah, overall, it's just personnel that's the problem.
Yeah, and quite a big problem. Certainly in that sense, seems to have caused much more consternation than the men's 11. And I suppose we start with what seems to me to have been the main headline, Alex, a complete omission of any FC Barcelona players. FC Barcelona having put together one of the best seasons that a club has seen, I suppose, in 2021, but none of their players rewarded by their fellow professionals in this team.
Yeah, that was entirely mind-blowing, to be honest. When you look at just this past year and you just look at the different awards, even in the FIFA best, you know, top two players out of the top three were from Barcelona, Alexia Putellas and Jenny Hermoso. Ballon d'Or, there was Lique Martins, Jenny Hermoso. You know, Barcelona players have been in every single award nomination this past year because of everything that they achieved. So when you look at it on a global stage, just looking purely at the football, you know, they're playing some of the best football in the entire world right now, men or women, I think even. You just look at the contrast between Barcelona men and Barcelona women at the moment. So just to not have any of these players, regardless of what they accomplish with the national team, club team, just to not to have any of these players on the, like, in that starting 11 is just, it's absolutely ridiculous when you think of it.
Michael, just give us a sense of exactly how dominant this FCB side are. Like, we're not talking about a team that did well, right? This is as high performing a team unit as has really been seen, right?
I mean, it was incredible. I mean, they came pretty close to winning every game in the La Liga campaign, the Champions League final. They were up against Chelsea and really won it within the first 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, it was just a complete walkover in the second half, really. It was a non-event. And, you know, as Alex said, it's not just about the results, because I think in certain leagues, not just within women's football, within men's football, the leagues are very unequal, and you do see teams racking up these results, but the kind of fluidity and the cohesion they play with, I think, really is quite remarkable to watch. And with all due respect to the Lyon side that was so dominant for the best part of the decade, it does feel like women's football has been taken to another level, really.
I saw a tweet from someone called Liam on Twitter who said, I propose Barca Femeni play against the FIFA Pro World 11. Alex, it's a bit cheeky, really, but were last season's Barca side to play this FIFA Pro World 11 10 times, would Barca win the majority or the FIFA Pro World 11?
Honestly, yes. We put a post on this for DAZN Football, and all the replies were just jokes. Basically, I think 7-0 was like the least score that I saw of all of it. But basically, you put Barcelona up against the side, they're going to be completely annihilated. I think Cristiano Ronaldo will have a lot to do. Maybe she'll keep the score down, but I don't think it could be possible.
Now, another slightly less standout, but still fairly serious group of omissions, which are noted from Katie Wyatt's piece about this topic on the Athletic site, which went out today. There was also not a single member of the Canada squad that won the gold medal at the Olympics. Is that as egregious an omission as no FC Barcelona players?
It's an interesting one with Canada, because if you look at the way Canada achieved the gold medal, it isn't to the same standard as like standard of football. And I'm not saying it's a bad side. It's just when you look at the two contrasting types of teams that they are, you know, Canada won a couple games on penalties because they weren't able to see off the game in regular time, for example. So it's just very contrasting. But individual players in the Canadian side, when you put that together with what they've achieved on the club side. So, for example, one example, it would be Ashley Lawrence, who plays as left back for Canada and for PSG, you know. They won the title for the first time in the history of PSG. You know, she's had a lot of players in her pocket in the Champions League. So you look at individual players of the Canada side, and I would say it's still a robbery of the omissions. Mm. But overall, I think it's not as, let's say, dramatic as the omissions of Barcelona players.
Yeah, understood. I suppose if we're saying that there really should be some Barcelona players in there should be some, maybe one or two of the Canadian stars as well, who won the Olympics. That does mean that what we're suggesting is a lot of the players that were selected are not really in there on merit. Now, we're not really a podcast that likes to criticise or take away from players necessarily. But Michael, Alex, which of the players that are included in this are the most surprising to you?
You definitely have to start with Carly Lloyd, the biggest name. You know, Alex Morgan, it's still bad that she's there, but you know, she's been playing. You know, she is Alex Morgan. You look at this, she's not as consistent as she was before, but you know, some of the finishes that she can pull off, you know, she's still one of a kind. But when we look at Carly Lloyd, she's been on her downfall for quite a few years now. You know, she's a player that literally just retired, so to put her in a world best 11 on the year that she retired isn't necessarily it's kind of like a farewell more than a you did good this year, let's put you in the best starting 11 in the world. So I think Carly Lloyd, Alex Morgan would be kind of the two biggest ones for me in terms of football and kind of what they've done. When you look at the calendar year, they haven't really done that much.
Michael, I get the sense that it's kind of a repeat of what we spoke about as part of the men's 11 as well. Maybe a certain deference to, you know, the most iconic players of a generation that actually is not impacting the game at the highest level as much as they did a few years ago. Do you get a strong feeling of that in this team as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's slightly more difficult with the women's one, because when you look at the clubs these players play for, they're across three different continents. You know, Marta's playing in Brazil, you've got two who are playing in the US, and the rest are in Europe. So, I mean, it is quite difficult for players to keep across football when it's so spread out. And I think that is the interesting thing about the women's game at the moment. There are kind of various sources of power. I think a few years ago, kind of playing in America was seen as the be-all and end-all, whereas now, because of the expansion of the Champions League, etc., more money in the European leagues, is becoming a little bit more like the men's game. But, you know, I must admit, I'm kind of deferring to people like Alex when it comes to Kylie Lloyd and Alex Morgan, because over here we don't see club football from North America or indeed from South America in terms of Masters level of performance. But yeah, it certainly feels like the game has changed a little bit. And I think probably the best Champions League 11 that was voted for at the end of last season would probably be fairly close to what you'd want the World 11 to be.
Yeah, let's not get into all the things I have to do to watch women's football. but I definitely agree with Michael. You're starting to see a shift into kind of European football and all the big names coming here, like making an effort to come here. And I think COVID actually helped that. So one positive to take from that was kind of, obviously the NWSL in the States didn't really have a full season with COVID and just different availabilities of seasons. I think European leagues were kind of the ones that actually kept going for as long as they could, obviously. And then you have the Champions League as well, expansion, you know, broadcast deals, money pouring in. So, you know, at one point, the Australian team, for example, you know, they were probably most of them were scattered around the NWSL, and now none of them are there anymore. Obviously, Sam Kerr to Chelsea, et cetera, et cetera. So you're seeing this shift into European football that wasn't there before. European football used to, I mean, it was still really good. You look at the history of the Women's Champions League, it's still amazing. But the NWSL was kind of the place to go develop your football. And even now you see most of the players that have played that are playing the Women's Champions League, Kim Little for Arsenal, for example, went to the States. You know, Emma Hayes for Chelsea used to coach in the States. So that was kind of the go-to filter, I guess you can call it, at the start of a lot of careers. But now you're seeing a shift over, and yeah, it's difficult to keep up with it. But hopefully it'll start being a bit more accessible and obviously a bit more central to kind of at least to see, you know, a team like Barcelona play.
I will just ask you a bit about the accessibility, or realistically the inaccessibility of women's football, because I think it appears that that has a big impact on what we're talking about and why this team looks the way that it does. As Katie wrote on the Athletic site, closer to a Legends 11 than a selection of the year's best players. And, you know, we have to realise the judging panel are the players themselves. They do follow the game much differently to us. But it does make it seem like they're not watching a lot of women's football as it happens, as you've alluded to there, not just because of the different time zones and the different sort of concentration of the teams in the leagues, but just in terms of how to find it, how to access it, how to watch it. Huge mitigating circumstances on this front as well. If you find it difficult and it's something that you're so passionate about that it's become your job, difficult for a player to watch a lot of WSL games, for example, they often take place around the same time.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, just to that last point that you mentioned there, you know, most of the games start at the same time. So even myself, I play on a Sunday. So half the time I am missing two or three WSL games at a time that I do have to come back and rewatch somehow, usually on YouTube, thankfully. But it's little things like that. And then you look at Spain, you look at Barcelona, you know, they're the team that you want to be watching at the moment. And look at the broadcast deals in Primera Iberdrola right now, and there's no broadcast deals. So these fixtures aren't being announced. They're being announced probably a week and a half ahead of time. You don't know the schedule before that. You don't know where you can watch it. Luckily, Barcelona does have an in-house production team, but when they go to away games, you know, the clubs, lower table clubs in Primera Iberdrola have really limited resources, much less a production team. A team like Barcelona, who just won the Champions League, who Alexia Poteas just won the Ballon d'Or, you can't watch their games. It's as simple as that. You literally cannot watch it. So that's just one example. But if you want to watch leagues from other countries, you know, if you're in the UK, if you want to watch a Bundesliga match, it's very limited on how to watch it. If you want to watch an Italian league, I have yet to find a good place to watch Italian women's football because it's so scarce and it's so random, the places that you broadcast it. So yeah, I really try hard to watch as much women's football as I can. And I do go through a lot of lengths to do it. And I know not a lot of people are willing to do that. And it's a shame that you have to go through so much just to watch a team like Barcelona, for example.
Okay, so, you know, getting past the initial shock of some of the most notable omissions, we sort of come to understand a little bit the process of how the voting works and maybe some of the circumstances around why we end up with a team that looks like this. A team, of course, that you guys both disagreed pretty strongly with and are fairly well placed to put forward what we would consider to be a better version. So now's your chance. We asked you to select your teams just as Michael and Mark did earlier. So it'd be interesting to know, Alex, perhaps starting with you, how many Barcelona Femení players do you have in your team?
Five. I tried to limit as much as I could because I do know there's a lot more talent, but I think the five that I picked are irreplaceable. Mm. It was really hard, but I managed.
I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the Barcelona men's team under Pep Guardiola those years ago, where four or five of their players, because of the level that they played at, and you couldn't really leave them out based on what they were achieving. It sounds similar here. Why don't you talk us through goalkeeper and your defence? Who have you got in?
I have Christian Eller in the goalie position.
Is that just definitive, no questions, no arguments, clearly the best goalkeeper in women's football?
It's complicated because you have... I'm Chilean, so maybe I have a bit more attachment to her than anything else. But I think the presence that she has on the pitch, and I tried balancing it out a lot with the national team. You know, Akintry Berger for Chelsea is arguably one of the best goalkeepers in women's football, but she doesn't play for the German national team that much. So she doesn't have that side to her game just yet. Sandra Paños is good, but I would maybe trust Christiane Eller a bit more. Mm-hmm. When you look at the accolades that she won with PSG, obviously again, won the league for the first time. She was a big factor in that. And then you look at the national team, you know, Chile is not a good country in women's football at the moment. And just to kind of give you the kind of player that she is, I remember in the 2019 Women's World Cup, Chile played the USA, lost 3-0, and Christiane Eller still came out player of the match. So she has that presence on the pitch, which I think is really, really important in women's football.
And who'd be defending her goal in your team?
So right back, Ashley Lawrence, PSG in Canada. Mapi León, Spain, Barcelona as my right center back. Left center back, Magda Eriksson, Chelsea, Sweden. And left back was my most complicated decision. I think I took about half an hour to pick this player. And I went for Julia Gwynn of Bayern Munich and Germany.
Interesting that you had so much trouble with this, given what you said earlier, that Magdalena Eriksson in the official team was shunted out to left back, which is maybe not necessarily her natural position. So, you know, you're struggling with this just as the professionals did.
Yeah, I was gonna go for Fridolina Rolfo as my left back as Barcelona. I did that cheekily a couple times already. Obviously, she's a central striker, but Barcelona have been using her as a left back, and she's actually done quite well. So I was gonna do that, but I decided to go for an actual fullback.
Michael, I'm seeing some similarities in your team as well.
Yeah, well, I did the Eriksson at left back thing, and I think it's justifiable. One, because she plays left sided centre back now since Chelsea switched to back three. Two, because she pretty much did play left back in the FA Cup final when Chelsea kind of shifted across to back four. And she played at least a couple of games for Sweden at left back when they got to the Olympic final, only lost to Canada on penalties. And so because she is my left back, I put Erin Paredes as a centre back. She is at Barcelona, although wasn't there when they won the Champions League. She came in the summer. And my other two are the same as Alex's, Mapi León as a centre back. And Ashley Lawrence, I mean, you mentioned earlier, Ali, about the lack of a Canada player. I think it was in itself, I don't think it was shocking, but I mean, it was just so easy to get a Canadian in because Ashley Lawrence had a really good Champions League campaign. And also, the two or three games I saw for Canada in the Olympics, she was by far the best player. I mean, just so much kind of energy and thrust and forward running. And the interesting thing about her is she's really comfortable playing left back or right back. So that's obviously quite handy for a team like this where... I think fullback was probably the most difficult position to find players for.
How about in your midfield, Alex? We had Bernini, Bonansea and Lloyd in the official team. Any of them in your 11?
No. For different reasons. I mean, to be fair, I do have to say that I do rate Stefania Bernini quite a lot. I do think for some reason she's a player that hasn't been at the top level. She's played, you know, NWSL, she's played in Spain now, but she's never really gotten the recognition that she kind of deserved. But I think it's kind of blowing over slowly So I do rate her, but I don't think she should be in the World 11. Also considering if we're balancing international games, she hasn't played for the national team since 2019. So slight problem with that one. Mm. But for my middle three, I'd had to go just with the Barcelona midfield. I couldn't. I mean, there's so many players that, I mean, you know, you can put Lena Oberdorf, for example, I rate her. Amandine Henry, you know, there's endless. I can make like 10 different midfield trios. But the way Spain have done, just to talk about Spain just a little bit, in 2021, they had a perfect record and did not concede not one goal in the entire year. You know, and they played against the Netherlands, Denmark, Scotland, Belgium, Mexico. You know, yes, they played against smaller nations, but they still played against big nations and still managed to get this record. And that midfield trio is unbelievable. I couldn't, they're irreplaceable, really.
Just talk me through the balance of the midfield three. What are they offering? Why is it working so well together?
I mean, you have to look at it, Pep's Barcelona. It's the same midfield dynamic. You know, you have a deep line six, Patri, who has techers in her like no other. You know, she's doing things on a defensive side of things that you would just not do, even on an attacking side of things. So her calmness, you know, she's 23. It's unbelievable, the calmness and the experience and kind of the presence that she has on the pitch. And then you have Aitana Bonmatí and Alexia, who play kind of, they interchange, I think, the 10 and 8 role, but they do stay on, like, Alexia stays on the left side, Aitana plays on the right side. And of course, when you look at a Barcelona, a good Barcelona midfield, they interchange a lot with the front three. But the balance that each of these players, you know, Aitana is 24 years old, so Patri and Aitana are really, really young. Alexia is kind of the more experienced one, but both of them came through La Masia. The Barcelona style of play is embedded deep into the three of these players. So if you look at them play, the ball movement, Patri, I think, is probably, obviously Alexia is, but I think Patri is probably single-handedly the most important player for Barcelona in terms of progressing the ball, getting the ball out, and just, again, you know, dictating the rhythm, playing out the back. But it's just, you just have to watch them play. And if you know men's football, Pep's Barcelona, it's this midfield trio would slot in quite nicely there.
Yeah, all very recognisable, as you've said, from previous sides that we've seen. Michael, you decided to play a different formation, which meant no space for three central midfielders, which means you did go with a Barcelona duo, but no Patri, no Party for you.
Yeah, of the three, I ended up leaving her out. Yeah, just because he's over formation reasons. But I think those two, I mean, Piteas has just kind of swept the board in terms of individual honours. But I think Bonmatí, particularly in those Champions League games, the semi-final, one of the semi-finals in particular, just the level of control she brings to the midfield is just extraordinary, I must say. I mean, Piteas is the better player and does the more spectacular things, but Bonmatí is the one I really enjoy watching, and just her control of the game, I think, is unmatched. So, yeah, I just went for the two. But if there'd been a three, I guess you do have to go for the three of them together.
And four attacking players for you, Michael. Who are they and in which positions?
Yeah, you'll probably tell me off for the formation because I'm slightly squeezing in four attackers. Jenny Hermoso was the forward. I think her Champions League final performance in particular against Chelsea, she was just pulling him, you know, perfecting the false nine role, pulling him out of shape all over the place. I've got Miedema. I must say, I almost didn't think of Miedema because she wasn't in the Champions League last year because Arsenal didn't qualify when there was only two English sides in the Champions League. But then I looked at her stats and I realised that she had another incredible year. 25 and 26 last season for Arsenal, 14 and 12 this season for Arsenal, and also 10 and 4 at the Olympics. I mean, I remember her missing a penalty at the Olympics, so kind of was thinking she had a difficult time. She scored 10 in 4, which is a pretty good record. And then I've got Fran Kirby. I mean, she was the WSL Player of the Year, just incredibly consistent down the right flank. And the final position, there were quite a few names in the mix. I thought of Fridolina Rolfo, who hasn't really played there but has played either up front or, as Alex says, at left back. I thought of Blackstenius, who's just signed for Arsenal, but I can't say I saw her much in the Swedish domestic league. So I went for Sam Kerr in a kind of roving left-sided role, which I've kind of seen her play before. I sometimes find her quite frustrating because I think she should score more goals, but her runs and her movement are fantastic, and some of her finishes I remember being at the game against Wolfsburg. I think I saw you there, Alex, before that Wolfsburg game. And the finish was just kind of on the run from a ball over the top of the defence, chipped over the goalkeeper with the outside of her right foot. When she does finish well, she produces some absolutely incredible finishes. So I found a place for her kind of on the opposite flank to Kirby, who she combines very well with.
And three attacking players for you, Alex.
It was hard. Kerr was out, unfortunately. She went to my bench. But I have Harder on the right side. I think Prinio Harder is just an irreplaceable player again. The things she does, and you know, when you see things like Sam Kerr, they play off, you know, the Kirby connection plus Harder is just amazing to watch. But I think Prinio Harder for me is kind of the player I enjoy watching the most, you know, outside of Sam Kerr's ridiculous finishes sometimes. Prinio Harder's movement and the space that she picks up the ball in is really interesting. So she's on my right side. Jenny Hermoso down the middle. That was a hard one to compete with Mirama. But I did go with Hermoso because of actually what Michael said there, you know, the positions that she takes up on this Barcelona side and the way she is able to play with the midfield and the wingers that I'll get into now. It's just mesmerizing to watch. And she has picked up quite a few kind of stats, breaking stats. I mean, she scored 51 goals in 2021. So that's not too bad when you put it that way. And on my left side is Mariona, again, Barcelona and Spain player. For me, she's arguably, again, outside of Alexia, she's probably my second most favorite player. She can play central striker. She can play on the left. She can play as a 10. The way she moves, even if she plays on the left side, you will find her on the right side for some odd reason, just picking up the ball and kind of just crossing it in or dribbling in. But the spaces that she's able to find, pick up the ball, distribute, and receive the ball again is just mind-blowing. And it's just mesmerizing to watch her play. And I think she's in any of my squads. She's always going to be in it. And again, you know, she's crucial to Spain and Barcelona. So I think she's always going to be my starting 11.
I'll just ask you to recap your 11s. Michael, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I don't think I actually said who my goalkeeper was. I think I forgot to mention that. Apologies. But I went for Ann-Kathrin Berger. I mean, there was three, Panos, Enola, Berger, I think probably in a category of their own. I know that would annoy Alex because she's a Chilean Barcelona fan. I've left out the Chilean player and the Barcelona player, but probably a little bit of bias for me because I've watched more of Chelsea than any other side. And I remember her saving two penalties in the quarterfinal, was it, against Atletico Madrid in the Champions League. So I went for her. So yeah, I've got Berger in goal, Lawrence, Mapileon, Paredes and Eriksen at the back. I've got two in midfield of Puteas and Bonmati. And then I've got Miedema and Hermoso as the front two, and Kirby and Kerr kind of running in behind from the wider positions.
And Alex, some similarities, but also some crucial additions to your side, some crucial differences.
Yeah, I went for Cristiano Lerengol. Maybe it is the Chilean bias, but I'll leave it at that. I have Ashley Lawrence as my right back, Mapi Leon and Magda Eriksson as my centre backs, and Julia Gwynn as my left back, Patri, Aitana Bonmati, and Alexia Poteas as my middle three, Prinio Harder on the right, Jenny Hermoso down the middle, and Mariona on the left.
So Mark and Michael have five players who were the same in their men's World 11s for 2021. And you guys share six, I make it. And that's three in defence, Lawrence, Mapi Leon, Eriksen, the midfielders from Barcelona, Alexia and Bonmati, and then Hermoso up front as well. Michael, how many from the real official FIFA Pro World 11 made it into your 11?
I think I've got two, Miedema and Eriksen. So two out of 11.
Yeah, I've got two as well, and Lauren and Eriksen.
Well, in that case, it was a very worthy exercise because I think in discussing how we ended up with the official FIFA Pro World 11, we understood a little more about the factors, the mitigating circumstances that lead to it. But then it's certainly good to get from Alex, an expert of the game, and Michael as well, for you guys to share your thoughts so that we have a slightly better idea, perhaps, of who should be in these teams. And I think justice for FC Barcelona Femení as well, it's fair to say, on the pod today. Alex, a huge, huge thank you for joining us and for lending us all of your expertise on this topic.
No, thank you for having me on. It was enjoyable.
And of course, Alex, as mentioned, is the host of the Box to Box WSL podcast, which looks at the tactical side of the women's game as well, and absolutely worth a listen. Michael, you've been a pleasure as always. Mark, thank you for joining us earlier. This has been the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Michael and Mark are working away on the Athletic site, providing the best written content out there. Theathletic.com/tactics is the place to go to get a 33% discount if you'd like to sign up to an annual subscription today. Now, Mark, Michael and I have got some quite interesting ideas for the coming weeks, so stick with us. A few tricky tactical and analytical football questions designed to help us understand and see the game a bit better. That's what we're trying to do on this pod each week. Thanks as ever for choosing to listen to us today. It means a great deal. Make sure you join us again next week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.